It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. In fact, a special pledge drive edition of Politics Day. I'm Ben Kiefer, along with Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, in our Ames studio. Hello, Stefan.
Hello.
David Redlaus joins us in our Des Moines studio. He's a fellow now at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. He's in our Des Moines studio. Dave, it's been a while. Thanks for coming back.
You bet. Happy to be here, Ben.
All right. A little bit later in the program, as usual on Politics Day, we want to pick up some of the bigger bumps on the political landscape this week. In fact, the scramble for John Boehner's successor, we want to talk about that, its significance. Also, the contentious Planned Parenthood testimony on Capitol Hill, which took place yesterday. But first of all, we want to talk about the State Historical Museum of Iowa's new exhibit to open on Friday. It's called First in the Nation, Shaping Presidential Politics Since 1972. It's an exhibit that will guide viewers through the entire history of the political contests in the Iowa caucuses, and displays guiding viewers on a roughly chronological tour of the caucuses from their origins back in 1972. To 2012. Here also to help us do that, Leo Landis, State Curator for the State Historical Museum of Iowa. Hello, Leo. You're in Des Moines as well. Welcome.
Thank you, Ben. Great to be here.
And let's talk about this for a few minutes. So what will visitors experience when they walk through the door for the exhibit on Friday or the days that follow?
We did do a mix of chronology and experience for the candidates and their interactions with Iowa. So we do start out talking about 1972 with Muskie and McGovern when the Democrats set their caucus as the first in the nation. But then we take it from a tack of looking at how candidates visit the state, organize their campaign, a little bit of the caucus culture, caucus day, the night of the caucus, and then the onto the primaries or the days after the caucus too. So we even take it to convention.
Mm-hmm. You have some interesting artifacts on display. Share a couple of those.
We do, and some of them are – we try, of course, as the State Historical Museum to connect to the Iowa stories, and we tell a little bit of Jimmy Carter's 1976 success that really helped establish Iowa as a great place to compete. But then by the 1980s, you get people like Jesse Jackson coming into the state in the heart of the farm crisis and developing a relationship with Dixon Terry, and so who was a farm activist in the 1980s whose life was cut short by lightning. But Jesse Jackson set up his national headquarters in Greenfield for a while to prove that he could appeal to Iowa voters as well as urban voters. So we've got a great collection of Jackson material and have selected a few items there. Another kind of fun, kitschy, but also what represents what Iowans are about is a quilt made for the 1988 campaign by a woman named Eileen Devine of Sigourney. And she made squares of every state that had a candidate. So one side is the Republicans, one side is the Democrats. And then she had the candidates sign the quilt, and they auctioned it off at the Republican, raffled it at the 1988 Democratic convention, and then it came back to Iowa. So that's one that has a vice president's signature with Joe Biden on the Democrat side and a president's signature with George H.W. Bush's signature on the other.
Interesting. Leo Landa, State Curator for the State Historical Museum of Iowa. The new exhibit opens this Friday, titled First in the Nation, Shaping Presidential Politics Since 1972. Stefan, take us back to the origins of the Iowa caucuses. How did we end up being first here in Iowa?
Well, I want to congratulate them for that exhibit. I was on the board of the Historical Museum in the 2007 when the first huge exhibit rolled out, and I think it's fantastic that they're repeating that. It was such a success. Actually, what happened was there were some reforms in the Democratic Party that were caused by huge turmoil in the party. George McGovern and some other people passed these reforms, which changed the way that delegates were selected. And that meant that caucuses and state party organizations were now forced to change their rules and include more women and minorities and other participation instead of the bosses picking them. And the committee in Iowa that had the chair of the Iowa Democratic Party, as well as two people from Ames who were very active in that, realized that you had to do the precincts and then report all that information from all the Democratic precincts to the county convention and then from the county convention to the district conventions and then the state party convention. And they realized that with the technology of 1972, they couldn't do that unless they started really early, because all they had was a mimeograph machine. Now, your listeners may not even know what that is, because I got interviewed by the the National Journal interviewed me, and the guy's probably in his early 30s. And I said, mimeograph machine. And he said, what is that? So I had to send him a picture of the mimeograph machine and a description, because you had to type this stuff up on a stencil, put it in a machine, pour in a lot of nasty liquid, and then normally hand crank out each of the reports. And so they decided that in order to get all the paperwork from the precincts to the next level, they had to start early. And they said, well, we'd better do this in January. Mm-hmm. And they did it in January, and it was the first of any of the caucuses in the country reporting back to their state party. And the 72 caucuses were not a national event. They were just what caucuses normally are, which is a party organization event. But because it was scheduled early, the next one, of course, was also scheduled really early, and that was the incredible 1976 caucuses that launched Iowa caucuses into national and international fame, with Jimmy Carter, Jimmy Who winning.
Right. Let me ask David Redlaws to pick up the story there. In 1976, Jimmy Carter comes out of nowhere. This is really interesting too, to see some of his old. You have an Iowans for Jimmy Carter T-shirt from 1976. He really ran as the man in blue jeans, a man you could just walk up to, shake his hand, and chat with, didn't he, Dave?
Yeah, and he was from Georgia, of course. Nobody knew who he was. And he personally spent a little bit of time in Iowa, but they built a campaign. They built an organization, seeing it as an opportunity to get some media attention for this guy that nobody knew, given that Iowa was coming even before the New Hampshire primary, which had been established for a while as the first primary. But one of the really nice and interesting things about the 76 event is that Jimmy Carter actually didn't win. He came in second to uncommitted, and leave it to Democrats to vote for uncommitted over any other person. But of course, from the media standpoint, it's not the story that uncommitted won. It's the story that this guy nobody knows won. The other thing about 1976 was, after the experience of the Democrats in 72, both parties agreed to hold their caucus on the same date, both Iowa parties. And the Republicans thought, you know, we should report something to the media as well. And they began the process that turned into what it is today.
And it became a bellwether for the nation.
And it did, exactly. And it did because, of course, Jimmy Carter won the presidency. The interesting thing about it is that between 1976 and 2000, no other Iowa caucus winner won the presidency.
What about Barack Obama, or was that not in the time frame you mentioned?
Yeah, that's after 2008.
2008, yeah. Of course. Okay, yeah. Wasn't listening to the dates closely enough. But yeah, we did see, Stefan, a period in which the Iowa caucuses were not picking winners until 2008.
But we were smart. What we said was, oh, you don't have to be a winner. In Iowa, you have three tickets out of Iowa: the winner, the second place, and the third place. And you get on the airplane and fly to New Hampshire, and then you have to do well there. And so the top, you could be anywhere in the top three, and you were very likely to get at least the nomination. And so we spun that as the magic of Iowa, which was, yeah, we don't pick the winner, but we picked sort of the top three, and then we let other states also participate in it. And David Yepsen became famous saying that there were three tickets out of Iowa, you know, first class, steerage, and, you know, back in, you know, in the cargo hold or whatever. And that became such a great thing for the news media to report. And so we hung on to that wonderful myth, you know, that Iowa actually is a place where, you know, first, second, or third, and that's it. And that's how it's gone.
Here is one candidate who got a third place ticket. This is a bit of fame. Now, going back to you, Leo, the 2004 caucuses ended with Howard Dean being in third place. I want to play a bit of audio in just a moment, from the moment that everybody remembers, that's played quite a bit. But you have some memorabilia from this time, or a large photo of that actually, scene?
We've got the large photo, but we also have a precinct captain shirt from Hamilton County. That's in the exhibit. So who was? Mm-hmm.
Do you have like a button, not the easy button, but the scream button? You can press it. And
we don't have that. We knew that might be a little too obvious, Ben. So we stayed away from that one.
Okay, let's listen back to the day after the Iowa caucuses in 2004. Who finished first in the Iowa caucuses in 2004? I don't have
John Kerry did.
Kerry.
John Kerry
and gets the nomination.
He gets
right.
the nomination. Sure. This is the third place winner. Talking to supporters, Tom Harkin in the background, who he references. Let's listen to the 30 seconds leading up to the scream.
If you had told us 1 year ago that we were going to come in third in Iowa, we would have given anything for that. And you know something? You know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
Yeah! Every time you hear it, it doesn't lose any of its charm, should I say? Tom Harkin, he references there. Tom Harkin running for president in 1992. That did something to the field, didn't it? The home state senator running for the Iowa caucuses. It wasn't a good year for the institution, was it?
If this is Leo, I'll jump in.
Yeah.
I think that is the main anomaly year. It's the only time that a fourth place finisher who didn't get a top three ticket actually goes on to win the presidency. So Bill Clinton gets fourth place that year, but comes back in New Hampshire as the comeback kid. And you know, we talk about that in the exhibit. Is you know the 92 caucus gets a little bit of a skew there, and you know. Credit of Senator Harkin for running a good campaign here. It just didn't translate nationally.
Leo Landis, as curator of this new exhibit, any surprises you want to share, challenges you didn't expect?
You know, there's been so much good work in the past, and that's one of the things we'll be highlighting, too, on opening day on Monday, is we'll have David Yepsen in to offer some commentary in the morning at 7:30, along with Dr. Andy McGuire and Dr. Marionette Miller-Meeks from the Iowa Republican Party. And then at noon, Stefan and some of his colleagues from Iowa State will be down. So if folks want more political analysis, we've got some good activities on Friday during the day. I think the biggest surprise to me was just seeing how a well-run campaign, and we've all seen this, it really, to me, is why Iowa makes sense, because you don't have to finish in the top spot, but if you do a good job, you can have a campaign that has some legs into a national campaign, and we're affordable, and people that work hard usually are rewarded.
Okay.
Ben, Dave here, too. And it's because the media comes and pays attention to it. It's not a matter of winning. It's a matter of beating media expectations, in which case you can, in fact, end up surprising and riding that at least somewhere forward into the process if you build the kind of organization, the kind of campaign that flies a little bit under the media's radar here.
Mm-hmm. In 2012, of course, we had this virtual tie between Santorum and Romney. Actually, Santorum, I think, winning by, eight votes? Repercussions for 2016 as we look to the coming caucus. Dave, will we do a better job of counting or a little different process?
Well, you know, when an election is essentially tied, it's always a problem to count it. Think back to Florida in 2000 where the government runs the election as opposed to the parties running the election. But there have been some repercussions. One was, of course, the would this kill the caucus? And I think the evidence at least today is that it hasn't for 2016. But a really interesting repercussion is the Republicans have changed their rules. And for the first time, the results of the Republican caucuses, the actual precinct results, will be what is reported in the national convention vote if it is a contested convention. That is, on the first ballot, Iowa's Republican chair will report what the percentages were in the caucus rather than individual delegates voting. And that's actually quite different and comes directly out of what happened last time.
Leo Landis, state curator for the State Historical Museum of Iowa, a new exhibit opening Friday. First in the Nation, Shaping Presidential Politics Since 1972, the title of a new exhibit that traces four decades of Iowa caucuses. Leo Landis, thanks for joining us this half hour.
Thank you, Ben.
Coming up, Stefan Schmidt and Dave Redlosk will stay with us as we pick apart recent politics on the landscape, including 10 reasons why the 2016 Iowa caucuses may be the last. That's coming up in just a moment, courtesy of Stefan Schmidt. We'll be back in just a minute with more Politics Day on River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. And we're back with more of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer, treading over the political landscape to see what's new and most significant this week with Dave Redlosk, a fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University in Des Moines. Stefan Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University, our analysts for this Politics Wednesday. Let's talk about the scramble for the House leadership. If all goes as planned, gentlemen, the House we'll know who its next speaker will be by the end of next week. Elections for the next House Speaker to be held Thursday of next week. Speaker John Boehner resigned less than a week ago, and the days that have followed have been filled of campaigns breaking out to replace him, to fill the party's also other top leadership spots. I think four positions opening up with the Speaker's position at the top of that list. California Republican Representative Kevin McCarthy, that's Boehner's current number two, announced earlier this week that he will run for Speaker. McCarthy has been a member of the House leadership since 2009, elected majority leader in 2014, considered a front runner. He was asked at a news conference how he may differ from Boehner as Speaker. McCarthy quipped, "I won't be as tan." Here's what else he had to say.
"I know what's going on across the country, and I'm concerned about what we hear. A lot of people in Washington concerned about power and institutions. I'm concerned about making a difference in everybody's lives. We want to make sure that we're closer to the people, that they feel this is their government, they're in charge, and we serve them. Now, that's not easy, and it won't change overnight, but that's our mission."
Okay, that's Representative Kevin McCarthy. Dave Redlosk, is there anything standing in Kevin McCarthy's way to be the next Speaker of the House that you see?
No, there does not appear to be anything. He's really the odds-on favorite. He will be the next Speaker. It's kind of hard to see anything that will change that, despite the the strong conservatives who essentially drove out Boehner. The real race is at the majority leader level between Steve Scalise from Louisiana, who's currently the whip, the number three position, and Tom Price of Georgia, who's the budget chair, who's arguing that red states, Republican-controlled states, need more representation in the leadership and the leadership needs a strong conservative like him to be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Stefan Schmidt, what are the biggest questions you have about what comes next in the House leadership when that election takes place next Thursday?
Well, I agree that, you know, probably McCarthy is going to get it. But you got to remember, lurking in the woodwork is House Freedom Caucus, Representative Mulvaney of South Carolina, and some of the other really Tea Party conservatives. They would like to see somebody else. And they think that you know, passing the torch on to the right-hand man of the outgoing Speaker, who was dishonorably chased out of his position, a disgrace, really, for leadership. When you think that this is the third most powerful person in this country, because that is the person who will become president if anything happens to the president and vice president, run out of Washington, D.C., and run out of his office by his own party. You know how that looks in Europe and other places? But there are Republicans who think that, you know, this will probably be more of the same. And so I think the division in the Republican Party is not healed by the transition. I think McCarthy is going to have lots and lots of pushback and people, you know, trying to demand things from him that, you know, that he's going to have to juggle.
Mm-hmm. Dave Redlosk, you agree? More of the same headaches for Kevin McCarthy that John Boehner has faced for several years?
Oh, yeah. It doesn't look like anything will change dramatically there. The reality is that the Tea Party side of the Republican Party wants things that really just, frankly, cannot happen given the makeup of our system. They want the Congress to put bills in front of Obama that Obama would certainly veto, but they can't get them through the Senate anyway because the Democrats can filibuster. And as long as the Democrats can filibuster, as long as the rules stay where they are, that's the bottleneck no matter what the House does and no matter how much a speaker might, give whatever to his right wing.
Dave Redlaus with us, fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. It's Politics Wednesday here on River to River. I'm Ben Kiefer. Yesterday in a House committee hearing, congressional Republicans challenged Planned Parenthood's eligibility for federal funds. It was a five-hour committee hearing, House committee hearing. Planned Parenthood President Cecil Richards appeared alone to respond to some hostile questioning from Republicans, some of whom have vowed to shut the government down if federal support for the organization is not cut off. Richards says defunding it would restrict women's access to care and disproportionately hurt low-income patients. Stephen and Dave, let's listen to some of the one of the fiercest confrontations of this hearing yesterday. Representative Jim Jordan, a Republican from Ohio, arguing with Cecil Richards over an apology she made after that first video was made public. If the videos were so misleading, he asks, why then did Richards apologize?
Because at the moment you did this, there were only one video. And then you do your video in response to that video, and you made a specific statement. I'm sure your staff worked on this. You prepared this. This was probably went through a number of drafts, and you were very specific in what you said. I apologize for the tone and statements. So there is obviously statements in that first video that were accurate that you didn't think were needed to be out there, and you wanted to apologize for it, and you wanted that message heard by the American people. And I'm asking you a simple question. Well, in that first video, tell me what you needed to apologize for.
That highly edited video that now, of course, as we have gotten further and I've read
that
pages
highly edited video that you apologize
pages
for.
And pages now, I have now read hundreds of pages of all of the things that were said, and what is clear now that there were many, I think 10 times during that conversation, in which Dr. Nucatola expressly said,
"It's a simple question."
Well, I've answered it.
It is as simple and as basic as it gets. You don't apologize for things that are inaccurate. You apologize for things that are accurate. And you said there were statements in that first video that I want to apologize for. I'm asking you to tell this committee chairman, this committee, and the American people, what were those statements?
Okay. Representative Jim Jordan, Republican of Ohio, with the testimony yesterday over the Planned Parenthood with Cecil Richards, president of Planned Parenthood. Meanwhile, here's another snippet from that testimony. Representative Gerald Connolly, a Democrat from Virginia, chastising his fellow lawmakers for the behavior displayed towards Cecil Richards.
The disrespect, the misogyny rampant here today tells us what is really going on here. This isn't about some bogus video, the author of whom does not have the courage to appear here, nor would the majority call him, because they know he'll make a bad witness under oath. This is about a conservative philosophy that says we are constitutionalists. They hold it up. We believe in rugged individualism and personal liberty, with one big carve-out, though. There's an asterisk in that assertion. And that is, except when it comes to women controlling their own bodies and making their own health decisions.
That is Gerald Connolly, Democrat from Virginia. Yesterday's testimony of Planned Parenthood President Cecil Richards. What do you hear there? Give us what you see as the significance or the background here. Culture wars going on Capitol Hill yesterday, Dave Redlask?
Yeah, culture wars playing to the base. Again, the very strong conservative wing of the Republican Party, for which this is a abortion is a litmus test. And the interesting thing about this is not in step with the American public, at least according to the newest Wall Street Journal poll. American public's favorable towards Planned Parenthood, 47-31, and it hasn't changed since July. And 61% of the public opposes eliminating funding. What I thought was really interesting is that just over half of GOP voters want to eliminate funding, which suggests that this isn't even, you know, an overwhelming position within the GOP. But it is a critical position to the strong conservative base that is really making itself heard these days.
Stephen Schmidt, what have you found interesting in yesterday's testimony?
Oh, this is absolutely perfect commentary, Dave. We have to remember, and people keep forgetting this, Congress does not have a national constituency. I mean, each member of the House of Representatives only really has to account to the people that elected him or her to Congress. And so Steve King doesn't have a national constituency when he makes decisions. He makes decisions based on what the voters in the 4th District of Iowa think and how and why they have reelected him. And so people with positions that are completely out of step with national polls or national preferences can make decisions and take positions in Congress that are totally diametrically opposed because they don't have they're not voted by a national electorate.
Let's talk about Governor Christie accepting an endorsement of a group of Iowa business leaders on Tuesday. Iowa business leaders led by an agri business mogul and also the president of the Board of Regents, Bruce Rastetter, one of Iowa's biggest Republican donors. He said Christie's record of governing with the Democratic legislature in New Jersey meant he could break through Washington dysfunction better than Republicans who just want to, in his words, burn the place down. Earlier on Tuesday, Governor Christie met also with Governor Terry Branstad. Thoughts about this endorsement, Stephen Schmidt?
Well, Chris Christie hasn't been doing as well as he wants, right? And I happen to know he was banking on New Hampshire as being his debut, his kind of prom. I happen to be a resident of Iowa and New Hampshire because I have some property up there. And so I keep in close touch and spend a lot of time in New Hampshire. And he isn't doing very well there. So I think he decided I'd better have a backup plan and a life jacket. And so I'd better roll out something in Iowa and see if I can do better in Iowa than I am in New Hampshire. And you got to remember that some of the people that now are really backing him again also did so several years ago when they wanted him to run for president. They flew to New Jersey to a dinner to try and talk him into it, and he said no, he wasn't ready for it. So it's kind of a repeat performance, and we'll have to see. Obviously, they're talking about Donald Trump and wanting to essentially find someone who they think is more electable than Trump. We'll see how Iowa voters line up. They already have their favorite candidates, and Chris Christie isn't really among them, but we'll see if this helps, you know, boost them up. I have to add that 22 or 33, I guess it was 33, really powerful moguls, as you called them, in Iowa, business leaders came out recently and endorsed Jeb Bush. I haven't seen Jeb Bush's numbers move very much, but we'll see if that helps Jeb Bush in
the
next
The question is, well, what is these endorsements good for? What do you think, Dave?
Yeah, I don't know that these endorsements move the numbers. They may send signals to other people with money. They may send signals to some activists. But, you know, Chris Christie, if he wants to really make any difference in Iowa, has got to put an organization together on the ground, and he's got to spend some time here. I've spent a lot of years, the last 6 years I've been at Rutgers University in New Jersey, and I've been following Christie. I run a polling center there. I've watched him, you know, at the top and at the bottom, really. New Jerseyans are not happy with him. His record with the legislature is probably not as good as it appears to national GOPers. But one thing is true about Chris Christie, despite the fact that he's not doing well in the polling in New Hampshire, he's very good in the one-on-one or small group and grassroots campaigning environments. He personally is very, very good at that. He engages people. He can campaign in a way that can work in Iowa. But frankly, what this pivot to Iowa is about is simply about his so far failure in New Hampshire. He needs the bump that doing better than expected in Iowa might get him.
Ben, can I add one thing? Mm-hmm. And that is that Chris Christie's brand and his whole persona was that he was the most in your face, that he was the one who spoke the truth, and by God, he wasn't going to take it from anyone. And unfortunately, he can't compete with the guy who really can do this, who is at the top of the polls, right?
Right, the Republican frontrunner, Donald Trump.
Exactly.
And also in the news, he gets in the news every week with something. This week, it's an overhaul of the tax code. Donald Trump would eliminate income taxes for millions of Americans, lowering them for the highest income earners and businesses as well. It's a plan that removes nearly 75 million households from paying income taxes at all. It restructures domestic tax brackets, removes certain deductions and loopholes. Gentlemen, your reaction to this plan, Dave Redlosk, is this anything new when it comes from a Republican, so dramatically different?
Lots of it is not dramatically different, particularly the reduction of the tax rates, the lowering at the top level especially. But what's really fascinating about it is it's another indication that the Republican field, and this is true of a lot of the tax plans we've seen, isn't particularly concerned about deficits. This tax plan from Trump would just literally take trillions of dollars from the federal budget and with no way to backfill that. It's truly just not practical. On the other hand, it is a play to a kind of populism that we're seeing in the GOP right now. GOP candidates who are basically making their case, the big guy's screwing you and somehow I'm going to fix that.
Mm-hmm. Stefan?
Well, I think that Marco Rubio, who is now moving up in the polls, needs to come out with his own tax plan, and it should be no one pays any taxes in the U.S. We are not going to have taxes anymore. If you want something, you pay for it. If you know what you want to have a military, pay for it. Use your MasterCard.
Want a new highway? Get together with some friends and
exactly,
put some money in a basket.
Exactly.
Let's talk quickly. We have about 5 minutes left. Let's talk quickly about each of the primary races. Since we're already with the GOP, let's start there. Donald Trump and Ben Carson, when we look at the polls running neck and neck in the national Republican presidential race, Carly Fiorina now tied for third place with Marco Rubio. This is according to the latest NBC News Wall Street Journal poll released earlier this week. Dave, what are you watching especially in the GOP race as we see some movement in these numbers?
Well, it remains the case that national polling does not mean very much at this point. This is a state-by-state race. You've got to build the organization. You've got to do well in the states as we go through the process. But having said that, the thing that has struck me now for the since the last Republican debate is that Donald Trump's numbers really seem to have peaked. The drop isn't much, but it's there. I think that we're talking peak Trump is at about a quarter of GOP voters, and 75% really do want someone else. They're not being persuaded to move in his direction.
Mm-hmm. Your read on the GOP race, Stefan?
Well, we have to remember that you can win the Iowa caucuses with relatively small percentages of participants, right? I mean, you can win it with 32%, 30%. You can, you don't have to have a majority. You don't really have to have a plurality, especially with a field this big. So if the field stays big and Donald Trump has 25%, and on caucus night, that's more than anyone else, he wins the Iowa caucuses. So that's one problem. The second is that there are too many people running, and so it's hard to change the numbers because those people all have a few supporters, in varying degrees, except for the stragglers at the end who should drop out quickly because they're below 1%. So Donald Trump has the advantage that no one can consolidate the rest of the Republican potential caucus participants so long as the field stays this large.
On the Democratic side, Dade Redlosk, as we run out of time here, Hillary Clinton is continuing to lose ground to Bernie Sanders in this same NBC Wall Street Journal poll or from earlier this week. She leads him She leads him by just 7 points with Joe Biden in the race, 15 points without the vice president in the race. Now, that's down from a 34-point lead over Sanders in July, down from a 60-point lead in June. On the Democratic side, how worried should the Clinton people be?
Well, certainly there's you know, reason to worry in the sense that you know, she's being challenged. She's being challenged hard. She's got to make sure she ramps up her game in response. On the other hand, I'll suggest it might not be a bad place to be if she's thought to be 7 or 8 points ahead coming into the caucus and wins it by 15. That'll be a huge story, and it'll blow things away, right? Mm-hmm. It's about beating expectations. If I were her, I'd be perfectly happy to have the expectations tamped down.
Mm-hmm. Stephen Schmidt, mm-hmm. before we go, you're coming out with an article in the Cedar Rapids Gazette this coming Sunday about the Iowa caucuses, the title of which is 10 Reasons Why the 2016 Iowa Caucuses May Be the Last. Give us a clue as to what you've written about there.
Yeah, and I'm going to move out of the state when that is published. I'm going to get more hate mail than I usually do. But, I mean, Reince Priebus told the National Journal, I have a couple of good friends there, and they sent me this before it was actually printed. He said there are no sacred cows, and Iowa and New Hampshire apparently are sacred cows in the primary and caucus process. And I think he is saying we need to reexamine whether Iowa and New Hampshire should be first. He's talking about some real screwy things like, you know, giving numbers to five different clusters of states, and then you run primaries in the states according to how they score on those numbers. So you could have, you know, Maine and Texas and New Mexico and Florida and Washington State and Idaho and Iowa in one primary, which would be a nightmare for candidates. How are they going to campaign?
But out of time. Do you see a path with which Iowa would be displaced?
Yeah.
I mean, Iowa by law is the leadoff according to our law, and we just move it if anybody tries to jump ahead of us, right?
Yep. Ben, call me a skeptic. Dave, call me a skeptic on this.
Okay, Dave.
It happens every 4 years,
yeah.
And the fact is that, in particular, New Hampshire will not go first, and
right.
Iowa will follow the same path no matter what rules the RNC tries to put in place.
So you're saying, Dave, there's no scenario you can see that knocks Iowa out of the first caucus place?
I don't think so.
Well, I think that's correct, but you know, it would be really a confrontation, you know, if
yes.
the parties decide, Iowa can go first, but we don't care. We're going to run a whole cluster of other states, yeah. and that's where all the delegates are, because Iowa doesn't produce a lot of delegates.
No. Nope.
You know, so that's a real problem, I think.
Okay, Stephen Schmidt and Dave Redlosk, we've run out of time. Stephen Schmidt, University Professor of Political Science at Iowa State University. Dave Redlosk, currently fellow at the Harkin Institute for Public Policy and Citizen Engagement at Drake University. So nice to have your keen political eyes on our political scene. Stephen and Dave, thanks for sharing your thoughts.
Thank you.
Matt, thanks.
I want to thank Jason Burns and John Pemble for help this half hour. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News.